Welcome to Season 3 of Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Senior Editor Kelly Davio. In the past decade of experience with the Biologics Price Competition and Innovation Act, a number of questions about the biosimilar approval pathway in the United States have been resolved through litigation. This week on the podcast, we're speaking with attorneys Robert Cerwinski and Alexandra Valenti, both of whom are partners at Goodwin, about experience with litigation, the road ahead for biosimilars, and Goodwin's recently published guide to biosimilars litigation. Robin, Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Not So Different.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
So let's start by talking a bit about the new book. Goodwin has recently released its guide to biosimilars litigation. What are some of the key topics that are covered in that guide, and who should be reading this book?
The guide covers really all legal and regulatory issues that we've either already seen litigated or expect to see litigated in the coming years that relate to biosimilar products. And the guide was designed for those of us who are steeped in these issues and deal with them on a daily basis, either from a legal or a regulatory perspective, but is also written with the intention that it could provide an introduction to the field for someone who's still a novice in matters related to biosimilars.
We tried to make the guide a useful research tool for those in industry who have particular questions about what's happened in litigation and particular topics to date, what's happened at FDA in terms of issuing guidances and decisions on guidances. We've also installed in the back of the guide a copy of the statute, all the FDA guidances that have been issued to date, and other useful reference material so that it's a volume that can sit on someone's shelf and they can refer to it, you know, as a research tool.
So in the years since the BPCIA created the biosimilars approval pathway for the United States, what are some of the big questions that we have seen resolved through litigation so far?
The first big question that was resolved, of course, was resolved by the Supreme Court in Amgen versus Sandoz, which held first that there was no ability for a private party to enforce the provisions of the BPCIA that pertain to the pre-litigation information exchange, known as informally as the patent dance, that those provisions aren't enforceable by injunction, and therefore they are effectively optional in practice for the biosimilar to engage in. That decision also held that notice of commercial marketing under the statute could be given at any time by the biosimilar, that the biosimilar didn't need to wait for product approval to provide notice of commercial marketing. So those were two big questions that were answered somewhat early on by the Supreme Court, but certainly there are many more open questions about the statute that we'll still be looking forward to litigation on in the coming months and years.
There's also a lot of collateral litigation that is open right now that's very, very interesting that we're watching. In particular, one litigation is the antitrust litigation that Pfizer has brought against Janssen on the product Remicade, which is infliximab. So in that case, Pfizer has alleged that Janssen's contracting practices with its customers for Remicade have unfairly and illegally excluded all biosimilars from the infliximab marketplace. And it's an interesting case for those of us in industry, because it's a set of tactics that we're wondering whether, if Janssen's successful, will be adopted widely by brand companies to defend the market and price of their branded biologics at the expense of biosimilars. And so, it's a very interesting case, but a kind of harbinger or a bellwether for the biosimilar market in the U.S. generally. So we're watching that quite closely.
Another open issue related to the statute, and again on the notice of commercial marketing provision, comes out of a recent decision in the District of Delaware on a preliminary injunction issue in a case regarding bevacizumab, Amgen's proposed, launched by a bevacizumab biosimilar product. The question there was whether Amgen was required to provide a second notice of commercial marketing once a supplement to its abbreviated biosimilar biologics license application was approved. And the court there held, in the context of a preliminary injunction decision, no, a second NCM was not required. But that case is going up to the Federal Circuit, and it will be interesting to see how the Federal Circuit rules, whether it limits its decision to the facts of that particular case or whether it comes out with a rule of law that might have broader implications for other biosimilar applicants and when they give notice of commercial marketing or when they're required to give notice of commercial marketing.
I think a final issue that we're watching quite closely, and that has been litigated on and off in various biosimilar lawsuits, is the issue of label carve-outs. So it's been pretty widely reported that many biologic products are protected by what has colloquially been termed a thicket of patents. And one flavor of patent protection that is usually applied to a branded biologic are different indications or medical uses. And one of the ways in which biosimilars have been attempting to reach the market as early as possible while steering clear of the brand's patent rights is to carve out the label for the biosimilar. What we mean by that is removing certain patented indications from the label and seeking approval to go to market on just unpatented indications. And the litigating the issue of whether a label carve out has been successful or not can be quite complex, in practice. And so we're really watching to see how courts treat these label carve-outs and whether biosimilar manufacturers will find that this is a pretty successful route for them to get to the market early or whether it's going to have some unexpected challenges.
So looking to the future, are there some legal issues that are related to biosimilars that maybe haven't arisen yet but that are expected to arise as biosimilar litigation matures?
The main issue that comes to mind for me is product liability claims. We haven't yet seen a case filed against a biosimilar manufacturer that claims some defect either in the design of the product or the manufacturer of the product or defect in warnings associated with the product. Those types of claims brought against drug manufacturers in the small molecule context has been frequent. But like I said, we haven't yet seen one brought against a biosimilar manufacturer. And the interesting thing that we'll be watching in that space is whether federal preemption principles that have been held to shield generic small molecule drug manufacturers from certain types of product liability claims will also apply in the biosimilar context.
I think another issue that we're expecting to see arise fairly soon, and we've seen sort of the beginnings or the rumblings of interest by brand companies litigating this, is the kind of streamlining of patent issues by district court judges that we've seen implemented in some courts when a district court is faced with a patent litigation that could involve as many as 40 patents, right? Some judges have used their powers to manage a particular patent infringement litigation in a fair and efficient manner to limit the brand to a certain relatively small number of patents or claims, so that the case is actually reasonably litigatable and fairly litigatable within, a couple of years' time. And brands have really been concerned about this, the streamlining by district court judges, on the ground that not permitting a brand or a patentee to assert whatever patents the PTO has issued it is unconstitutional, right? And is somehow taking a property right or preventing them from exercising a property right. And we expect to see that actually appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court at some point, if it becomes adopted on a widespread basis by district courts. So that's something that we're watching very closely, because this concept of patent thickets has been on a lot of people's minds, not just litigators, but also legislators. How do we deal with the fact that for these you know, large, successful branded biologic products, they are the patent office will often give 80 or more patents that cover various aspects of manufacture, formulation, stability, right? All different stripes of technology.
And I would just add on that the type of procedural case management type issues don't typically make it all the way to the Supreme Court. So if it does, it would be interesting to see how it plays out and whether it might have ramifications for other types of procedural issues being heard by the Supreme Court in the future.
So earlier you mentioned the Remicade litigation and the bevacizumab litigation that are both ongoing, as well as the issue of label carve-outs. Are there some other biosimilar litigation cases that you're watching closely now or that are of particular importance to the field at large?
One that comes to mind for me is this question, and it's arisen both in the biosimilar context as well as outside the biosimilar context, is whether the application of the inter partes review proceedings that were created by the America Invents Act in 2011, which allow for a proceeding at the patent office to challenge the validity of a given patent, whether the application of that proceeding to a patent that issued before the America Invents Act was written into law is constitutional, or whether there's a constitutional defect in applying it on sort of a de facto backward-looking basis. So that question has now been answered by the Federal Circuit in the negative. The Federal Circuit has held that it is constitutional to apply the procedure to a pre-America Invents Act patent, but it's one that, again, we expect will make its way to the Supreme Court sooner rather than later, and we'll see how the court rules.
I'll return back to the trastuzumab litigation that Alexandra mentioned. There, in that case, there are multiple biosimilar applicants, and the market started forming around various settlements. So Mylan was the first to settle with Genentech, and thereafter a number of other biosimilar manufacturers settled. And the settlements were, like in the adalimumab case, laddered in terms of staging biosimilar entry over a period of time. And Amgen, who was somewhat later to litigation, somewhat later to the FDA with their application than some of the earlier entrants, adopted a very interesting tactic. It does not appear to be willing to accept sort of the last place in settlement line, and instead it decided it was going to launch at risk. This is the preliminary injunction proceeding that Alexandra mentioned. It obtained a ruling from Judge Connolly that there should be no preliminary injunction entered, which cleared the way for Amgen to enter the market at risk. And we're watching this case closely because conventional wisdom had it that all the biosimilar manufacturers were simply going to get in line. Right, that there was too much risk associated with going to market at risk and trying to buck the settlement line. And Amgen has gotten very aggressive here. And if this tactic is successful for it, I think we will see this tactic played out again by at least the larger biosimilar manufacturers. So as a tactical case study, it's a very interesting and important one for us in the industry.
Well, lastly, we have recently seen a great deal of regulatory activity that either has had or will have an impact on biosimilar applications. Are there any of these developments that you would like to discuss as being of particular importance in this area?
So I think that the one regulatory issue that is really stumping us is the issue of interchangeability. Back when we first started blogging at BigMoleculeWatch.com, all things biosimilar, we had thought that a lot of the bigger, more sophisticated biosimilar manufacturers would take advantage of the interchangeability pathway available at FDA. And we thought that that would happen because in a market where there are multiple biosimilar entrants, the biosimilar entrants have to compete against each other as well as the brand in marketing their products to obtain market share, right? And there's price competition, there's sales forces. You know, it's a pretty aggressive kind of marketing that the biosimilars have to do vis-a-vis each other to distinguish themselves in the market. And we thought that biosimilar manufacturers would seek an interchangeability designation because almost all U.S. states have actually passed laws that would allow automatic substitution of an interchangeable biosimilar for the brand at the pharmacy level, which means that if you get an interchangeability designation as a biosimilar, your product will presumably get uptake in the market akin to a generic drug, small molecule drug. And that could be a powerful advantage over biosimilar rivals. It also is a marketing hook for biosimilars because you can tell doctors and you can tell hospitals that your product is the closest to the brand among all biosimilars. And you've proven it clinically with an interchangeability study, with a switching study. But we just haven't seen that play out. Really, the only study that's large-scale study that's been completed for a major biosimilar is BI's study for adalimumab, for its Humira biosimilar. There's some noise, some rumbling that we'll see interchangeability studies for insulin analogs, which are, frankly, simpler products. Right. When one compares them to the complexity of a monoclonal antibody, but short of that, really not a lot of activity. And the big question is why? Why hasn't this pathway that legislators thought was going to really stir vigorous biosimilar competition in the industry just not been used? And we hear from industry that, well, it's FDA's pathway to get an interchangeability designation is confusing. It's expensive. We don't know how much it's going to cost. We're not sure whether it's really going to give us, you know, any kind of advantage in the marketplace. So it's a head scratcher for us.
And insulin is the other product that I think has had a lot of regulatory activity on it recently. The product has had a lot of attention drawn to it by congressional hearings held earlier this year on drug pricing that really focused in on the price of and cost of insulin. And FDA now will be, pursuant to the statute, transitioning insulin from regulation under the prior framework to regulation pursuant to the BPCAA. So as it will be regulated like a big molecule under the BPCAA, the intent there is to open up insulin to the type of biosimilar competition that has now entered the market on other big molecules. And so it will be interesting to see whether FDA's efforts in encouraging applications for biosimilar insulin products, recently released guidance to that effect, will have the market impact that I think at least legislators are hoping to see.
Do either of you have any final thoughts that you would like to share with our audience?
I think that right now we are in a period in the biosimilars industry in which we've seen a big flurry of activity, right? A first wave of filings at FDA, of biosimilar applications, a first wave of litigation, and the wave of litigations is dwindling somewhat right now, right? We are seeing a steady stream of ABLAs being filed, but the first wave of litigation has started to wind down. And as we get to a mature biosimilar market in which the products that are becoming biosimilar eligible aren't the 10 or 12 that we've seen in the last couple of years, but the steady stream of 3 or 4 or 5. I think that, you know, what we expect to see is that biosimilars and biosimilar litigation are here to stay, even though there are question marks about profitability in the U.S. biosimilar market. There are question marks about interchangeability and the costs associated with development. Right, our expectation is that biosimilar manufacturers will continue to innovate in terms of lowering the cost of development of biosimilars. FDA will continue to gain more experience in approving biosimilars and lower the cost of actually getting approval. And that, you know, at least the major biosimilar manufacturers are here to stay and are committed to the market. And when one considers that biologics are really getting the lion's share of R&D dollars in the pharma industry right now, and most doctors view biologics as, you know, the medicine of the future, that these are, you know, far more effective tools for therapy than the small molecule drugs that we've seen, you know, in the past 100 years. We're really bullish on biosimilars. We think that market is here to stay, even though it's really shaking out right now.
Well, Rob and Alexandra, thank you again for sharing your insights with our listeners.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Not So Different. For a link to purchase the Guide to Biosimilars Litigation and Regulation in the U.S., visit our show notes. Until next time, find us at centerforbiosimilars.com.